Hey folks, Ben Birch here from White Rose Society. I don't usually interrupt your regularly scheduled programming, so I'll keep this brief. I am currently holding a fund drive to keep White Rose on the air. If you think what I do here is valuable, please visit our homepage at www.whiterosesociety.org and chip in to defray the substantial costs of this service. Thank you very much.
Welcome to the Tom Hartman Program.
This is Tom Hartman.
Taking back the mainstream media.
Now, here's Tom Hartman.
Well, when's a satire not a satire? This has captured the imagination, certainly, of the American media. Not so much of the Obama campaign. And when is a $100,000 guarantee by the FDIC, the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, not a $100,000 guarantee? And how can that be spread out? And when is the economy really just doing fine, thank you very much, when it's not doing so fine, thank you very much? And when is a war winnable, when it's not really winnable? John McCain saying, hey, I know how to win wars. Yeah, you did a great job there with Vietnam, John, and have you won any wars? I didn't notice. So greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. Shares of Washington Mutual and National City both plunged Monday as fears grew about the credit crisis plaguing banks. This from CNN Money. Regional banks. Are regional banks in trouble? Are the big banks in trouble? I mean, here we've had IndyMac. This is the second largest bank failure in American history. By the way, in the third hour of our program, Naomi Klein is going to drop by, the author of Shock Doctrine, the whole book about disaster capital. But she's going to be talking about FISA and China. I mean, there's just a lot to talk with Naomi Klein about. And we're going to be talking about, with a blogger who lost his job. This is in the third hour of our program. We lost his job because he was blogging about Don Siegelman. Interesting, discussing Don Siegelman. In the second hour of our program, Dan Gaynor is going to come by from the, he's the T. Boone Pickens Fellow and Vice President of the Business and Media Institute, to tell us how all this economic stuff, we're just a nation of whiners, you know. And it should be a very interesting conversation. But, you know, I want to begin with these issues. You know, what is a satire? First of all, if you go to TomHartman.com, on our homepage, you will see a satire suggested by Keith Tucker at What Now Tunes, whatnowtunes.com. And we put that cartoon, Keith's cartoon, on our homepage as well, with his permission. In the interest of fairness, we present the next issue's cover, and it's a cover, it's a suggested cover for the New Yorker. It's a picture of John McCain in the Oval Office with Adolf Hitler hanging on the wall, and he's wearing a Nazi uniform, and he's giving the salute, and he's saying, 100 years in Iraq. Yeah, I think that would go over very well. You know, there are two things that are really important for satire to work. And one is that there be an element of truth to it, and the other is that there be a context which makes it clear that it's satire. And the problem, in my opinion, and, you know, feel free to weigh in on this, 866-303-2270. The problem, in my opinion, with this New Yorker cover, which shows Barack Obama as in Muslim garb and his wife, Michelle Obama, looking like Angela Davis, you know, with the big afro, with an AK-47 slung over her shoulder, Angela Davis from the 70s, not even necessarily Angela Davis. I don't even want to diss Angela Davis. I mean, this just, you know, as the angry revolutionary African-American whatever. And Osama bin Laden's, loving portrait on the wall and the flag burning in the fireplace. The problem with this is, first of all, there's no truth to it. And the second is there's no context. And that's why it doesn't work as satire. It just doesn't work as satire. For example, if you wanted to do something that, you know, was funny and provided some context, let me reach into the Wayback Machine. You know, the Firesign Theater did just a lot of really, really brilliant stuff over the years. Phil Proctor is still sending out some great stuff. And, I mean, but the Firesign Theater, one of the all-time great groups. And so we could reach back and grab, you know, one of their short pieces and use it as satire for what just happened with Cindy McCain making $17 million on, presumably, on the sale of the fact that, you know, Anheuser-Busch, the American beer company, has now been sold to a foreign buyer. It's just, you know, it's just part of the ongoing process of the selling off of America that started with Ronald Reagan. As we went from being the largest creditor nation in the world to the largest debtor nation in the world, as we went from having a trade surplus and being the largest manufacturer of finished goods to being the largest importer of finished goods and having a trade deficit, this is the consequence of 30 years of insane economic policies. So now, you know, you've got a German company buying Anheuser-Busch. And so you could satirize her making $17 million on it, you know, John McCain, or you could satirize even the whole process by saying, okay, yeah, well, the Germans have looked at the American beer market and the American consumers, and they've figured out how Americans think about beer and, you know, what the average American is like. And so this is the context. And there is, you know, an element of truth to how some American beer drinkers think. And so here's the new commercial that is going to be running for the new beer that Anheuser-Busch is going to roll out. And as I said, this is an old Firesign Theater piece.
Yeah. See that bear lapping up that good old country water? Sure makes a big hairy guy like me thirsty. That's when I wrap my lips around that tall, sweaty, edible bottle of good old country Bear Whiz beer. As my daddy said, son, it's in the water. That's why it's yellow. Bear Whiz beer. Bear Whiz beer, liquid product, vendor there with Brewery Animal, Missouri.
Yeah, so here, I mean, that would be satire to do something like that, to do so, you know. But the problem with the Obama thing is it doesn't work as satire. Now, if the Obama thing, if the cover, because what they're saying, what the New Yorker is saying, is that the people that they were attempting to satirize are the bumpkins and idiots who believe these viral emails that have been going around for months and months and months. They're trying to satirize the Fox News hosts who, you know, was this a terrorist fist jab? But the problem is there's not a Fox News host in the ad. There's not that context. Just like, you know, I set up the satire of the Bear Whiz beer thing by providing the context of the sale of Anheuser-Busch and Cindy McCain making $17 million on it. So there's a context. So if there had been a context to this ad, to this front page, if the front page of the New Yorker had shown a Fox News TV, you know, set, and it had the big Fox logo across the top, and you had, you know, some woman showing a bunch of leg, you know, like the Fox News chicks do, thought police don't get on me for that, but. And the women of Fox News, I'm sorry, this is how Fox News thinks of them. I mean, they hire based on appearance, and show a little more leg here, please. And so anyhow, if they had a Fox News set and they had, you know, a bunch of Fox commentators pointing to this painting with very serious looks, that would be satire. That would be making fun of Fox News. If they had some, you know, country bumpkin, there was a great blog about this over at the Huffington Post yesterday. In fact, I think it's probably still up there. Bob Seska, as I recall, was blogging about this. And I'm looking right now. And I don't know where it is. But yeah, here it is. Well, maybe not. But in any case, it's where he suggested that if you had some, you know, toothless guy, you know, with a jug of moonshine with three X's on it, and you had this as, and you had this picture as the thought balloon over his head, that would be satire. Or if you had him looking at a computer screen, you know, some neo-Nazi looking at a computer screen seeing this picture, that would be, because then you're making fun of the idiots who believe this. But instead, just putting all of these stereotypes on the cover, in my opinion, as Michelle Bernard said yesterday, and I believe it was you know, quite accurate, she said, you know, why not simply portray Barack Obama as Sambo and Michelle as Aunt Jemima? I mean, you know, would that be funny? No. And it wouldn't be satire. This is not funny. It's not satire. And I believe this is really going to blow up in the face of the New Yorker.
The Tom Hartman Program.
Talk radio for the rest of us.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Much like me and you, I have a silly notion if we want them to be friends, they prefer that we don't torture them. But I'm a liberal.
He's a liberal.
I'm a liberal.
Unforgivable.
I'm a liberal.
See, this is satire.
I'm a liberal.
He's your typical liberal.
Right? It's making fun of liberals, but it's providing a context, and it's not, you know, really harsh. And there's an element of truth to it. This bumper is satire. You know, turn it back up again.
Early in the morning.
Liberal.
Now if we invade a country where lots of people die, the president should have to tell us just exactly why. And if he's caught red-handed, lying flagrantly, I think they should impeach the SOB. But I'm a liberal.
But I'm a liberal.
A liberal.
Right, you have the context around this. There is no context provided in this New Yorker cover. And that is why, in my opinion, it is not and does not work as satire. 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number. And Lewis in Somerville, New Jersey. Hey, Lewis.
Hi. I just think it's going to really sell a lot of copies, probably more than the Cy Hirsch articles do. And maybe if you will actually read some of the articles in it. And the ones I've read were pretty positive about them.
Oh, the magazine is it's a liberal magazine, and they've been very pro-Obama. That, you know, but frankly, I think that the damage this is going to do, forget about the number of magazines, because, I mean, how many people actually read a magazine in the United States? I mean, maybe a couple hundred thousand people will buy it, and maybe a few tens of thousands of people will read it, and maybe a few thousand people who wouldn't have normally bought it will read it. But I'm telling you that the Yahoos in, you know, literally from coast to coast, the folks who are reading these viral emails, who are watching Fox News, who actually think that this stereotype is true, are going to see this not just on the cover of the New Yorker, but as Chris Matthews said yesterday, this is going to be on T-shirts being sold on conservative websites, and you're going to see it showing up at county fairs and all over America. I mean, this is not funny, and this is going to harm this, and in my opinion. Jeff in Oak Park, Michigan. Hey, Jeff.
Hi. I think it actually does work as satire because you're saying that it doesn't have context. And the way that they're showing it online without the actual text on the cover, you're right. But if you actually read it where it says the politics of fear, then it's illustrating all the things that even some of the people in the Hillary campaign were using. They were the ones circulating that picture of him in the supposed Muslim headdress and stuff like that. So I think to a degree it does work. And the other thing that it might actually benefit is that people are going to be talking about it, that he really isn't a Muslim and that these things aren't true. And so maybe in some sense it might work to their benefit.
Right, except that I've already gotten a half a dozen emails this morning now from the usual sources, you know, the right-wing sources that are feeding the Hannity show and whatnot, saying the Associated Press has confirmed that Barack Obama was registered in his school in Indonesia at the age of 3 or 5 or whatever as a Muslim. You know, his mother apparently checked that box. And so, you know, that... and there, that's going to cause people, because a lot of schools in a lot of countries, they'll say, you know, what's your religion or whatever.
Sure.
And you know, his mother actually was an agnostic. And at that time, he had no idea what he was. I mean, he was a little kid. And but that kind of thing is feeding into the, oh, he went to a madrasa, he has a Muslim background. That's and I'm telling you, it's already happening. You should see the right wing stuff I'm getting on this. And you know, you and I, people who have some relative level of sophistication, I suppose, about this thing, who understand that this is over the top, you know, we could look at it and go, yeah, it's satire, you know, yeah, sure. And you're right. If it says the politics of fear, that is not being displayed anywhere. I don't see, you know, I'm looking at the cover right now, you know, online over at Huffington Post, and there's no text whatsoever, which strips it of context. John in Philadelphia. Hey, John.
Hey, Tom, I just wanted to call and maybe provide a little bit of, I guess, context to this whole thing. I'm an illustrator. I've done work for that magazine before. It's an incredible feat to take that amount of context that the article provides and inject that into an illustration that, by the deadlines, you probably completed that thing in 48 hours.
Yeah.
It's insane. The amount of information you have to...
No, but my point is, why not have this exact same photograph, only have it be a painting and have the cover instead be Karl Rove painting, finishing the painting? Then you have a set...
Because in a proposal, if you have 3 hours to give them 5 ideas, and then those 5 ideas come back and they have one thing, and then you have to complete this thing, you don't have the opportunity to provide as much context as someone as educated as yourself might need in a sort of rounder sense. You just have that deadline you have to meet. And with the stand-up guy, you know, he probably didn't mean to do it, but it's just the nature of the beast. You got to get the job done.
Yeah, no, I'm not trashing Barry Blitt. I mean, Barry Blitt, as the artist, did what he was commissioned to do. But I think that David Remnick and the folks at The New Yorker, I think this is just a terrible mistake. John, thanks a lot for the call. I do not think that this cover should have been done as it was. 27 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Give us a call at 866-303-2270.
Another song from GW, that's me, and the Carlisle Group. Here we go, get real close. Strangers in the night, exchanging gunfire, liberals so uptight, call me a liar, challenging my war, before my term is through. Something in their eyes is getting scary. Keeping to my plan is getting hairy. Every day it's hard to do the things I do. Justify my fight. Please, Limbaugh, Hannity, O'Reilly on the right. Keep my agenda on the burners burning bright. Because I'm so uptight, demonize the left today and take their right to speak away. And if
you
all succeed,
that's satire. There's an element of truth to it. 35 minutes past the hour. from the wire services, as we like to say here, saying he is sympathetic to late-night comedians' struggle to find jokes to make about me. Senator Barack Obama today issued a list of official campaign-approved Barack Obama jokes. The five jokes, which Senator Obama said he is making available to all comedians free of charge, are as follows. Barack Obama and a kangaroo pull up to a gas station. The gas station attendant takes one look at the kangaroo and says, "You know, we don't get many kangaroos here." Barack Obama replies, "At these prices, I'm not surprised. That's why we need to reduce our dependence on foreign oil." A traveling salesman knocks on the door of a farmhouse, and much to his surprise, Barack Obama answers the door. The salesman says, "I was expecting the farmer's daughter." Barack Obama replies, "She's not here. The farm was foreclosed on because of subprime loans that are making a mockery of the American dream." A horse walks into a bar. The bartender says, "Why the long face?" Barack Obama replies, "His jockey has lost his health insurance, which should be the right of all Americans." And a Christian, a Jew, and Barack Obama are in a rowboat in the middle of the ocean. Barack Obama says, "This joke isn't going to work because there's no Muslim in this boat." Thanks to Andy Borowitz, BorowitzReport.com. There's context, there's humor. Over at Democratic Underground, there's a thread. So when's the white satire going down? And Bronx Boy posted. He says, "You know about the upcoming New Yorker cover that shows McCain wearing a pair of Depends, you know, male diapers, while he calls Cindy the C-word, while slipping his hand under the dress of a demure telecommunications lobbyist as she pushes a telecom bill in front of him to sign? When's that one coming out? You know the cover, right? Rush Limbaugh in his studio talking about how Obama is a Muslim while, let's say, being inappropriate sexually down in the Dominican Republic and slipping $100 to his Hispanic cleaning lady to pay for his package. Oh, that would be incredibly humorous. You know, odds are, you know, you're just not going to see it. Karl Rove, as he boards a plane for parts unknown, will be flipping the bird to John Conyers. Nancy Pelosi kissing Bush while Bush Sr. shoves Monopoly money at her that has the word sucker written all over it. That would be satirical stuff. Phil Graham laughing at a working man putting $7 a gallon gas into his gas tank while committing an unmentionable act with Ann Coulter. On his desk is a banking bill. Give them whatever they want as long as the envelope gets slipped under the door. His signature on it. Yeah, that would be really funny. You're not going to see any of those kind of satires. Andre in Washington, D.C. Hey, Andre.
Hey, buddy. Thanks for taking my call. Sure. You know, a couple of points, and I hope I get a chance to talk to you about it. First, you're the smartest guy I've ever met or seen in my entire life. I love listening to your show. I think it doesn't work as satire because this is the country that elected George Bush twice. This is the same country that one minute Barack Obama, he's sitting in a revolutionary type church, listen to this, in a minister who hates white folks, but at the same token, he's a Muslim. So, you know, my only, I guess, complaint about that was, we're assuming that this country or certain parts of this country are smart enough that they're going to get it when that's just not the case.
Yeah, no, that's the exactly, and that's why it needed to be more explicit. Yeah. There needed to be a context in the cover. You've got a nation where, and Andre, thank you very much for the call. You got a nation where 13% of Americans believe that Barack Obama is Keith Ellison. Keith Ellison is actually a Muslim, and he's the congressman from Minnesota. He's been on the show a couple of times who. Took his oath of office. Actually, you take the oath of office without a Bible, but you take the photo op with the Koran. And in fact, the Koran he put his hand on was Thomas Jefferson's Koran. David in Oakland, California. Hey, David.
Hello?
Yeah, you're on the air, David.
Yeah, sorry about that, Tom. Yeah, I wanted to say that two tests that it also doesn't pass as satire is the fact that satire should essentially ridicule a folly or a vice in a manner to expose it. It doesn't do that.
Right, and that's my point, is that that what is being ridiculed here are the yahoos who believe this stuff, and they are not in the picture.
Exactly. But additionally, I might add that many progressives I've heard defending it and saying, you know, well, you know, it's just how people lost their sense of humor and it's just satire.
Right.
Well, hey, we've already shown it's not satire. But if this were, say, John McCain in a Nazi uniform with Joseph, with Joe Lieberman, who has been hawkish ever since he transferred to the Independent Party. If they were sitting there in Nazi uniforms, because he supports and they support the PNAC doctrine, and let's say that they were planning going and invading Iran as well as having dealt with Iraq and Afghanistan, it would not be seen as it would not be taken so lightly. Or right. Bill Clinton and Hillary Clinton were dressed in white supremacist clothing because they were accused of being racist during the primary campaign. I don't think it would be taken so lightly.
Yeah, no, I agree with you, David. I just think this is a terrible mistake on the part of the New Yorker. Andrew in Northampton, Massachusetts, listening to the
OHMP. I wanted to try and make a similar point that satire is designed to shed light on a subject, to reveal the truth. Mm. And this satire is only funny or satirical to people who already believe that truth. To people who don't believe it, to people who believe that Obama's a Muslim, that his wife hates white people, it's a caricature.
Right. Yeah, actually, absolutely. And Andrew, that's the perfect word. This is a caricature and not a satire. Well said. Well said. Dave in San Francisco. Dave, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I couldn't disagree with you more on this one.
Mm-hmm.
It's time for people to loosen up. Okay, the only people that are going to take seriously and go, oh, look at that picture on the New Yorker, he must be a Muslim, are people that are too stupid to read the New Yorker.
But that's the point. That's probably 95% of the American public.
You're shortchanging the American public. The people that I know, and believe me, I know the salt of the earth, not the college educated types. The people that I know are a little bit brighter than that. They can recognize it for what it is.
Yeah, our show, I mean, depending on whose numbers you're using, has somewhere between 2 and 4 million listeners, and that's a tiny, tiny, tiny slice of even the Democratic electorate. I mean, it's 50, 60 million people voted for John Kerry, as I recall. It was 58 or 59, something like that. I mean,
that's got more to do with political philosophy than education, though. And the ability to recognize either satire or caricature or whatever you'd like to call it.
Yeah, well, Dave,
But the fact of the matter is that the lefties in this country that are jumping up and down and screaming about this thing are basically looking like they're making themselves look really clenched up.
Yeah, well, sorry, Dave. A, I'm not clenched up. B, I'm not jumping up and down and screaming. And your caricatures of my behavior are not satirical either. Mark in Portland, Oregon. Hey, Mark.
Hey, I used to be an editorial cartoonist back in the early 90s for a university newspaper in the Midwest, and for a week I did a series on racist images, and I kind of gave some of the racist images some play in terms of giving context, but for instance, the racist image of Chief Wahoo, the Cleveland Indians mascot, which is, in my opinion, clearly racist, I had him interviewed, and the interviewer said, "So where do you get your good looks?" And he brings over his friend Sambo,
Mm-hmm.
And so you have it in context that one image is clearly racist, the Sambo.
Right.
Whereas Chief Wahoo is still considered, palpable by the general public standards, which is wrong.
Right. But what you're doing with that satire is making a point, revealing a truth, and providing a context to do both of those two things.
Right. Now, it was interesting because I got a lot of blowback from the African-American community over the cartoon, but I got a lot of support from the Native American community.
Mm-hmm.
So, but it brought up a discussion about, well, why is this image considered racist and this one is not? And right. That's what's so important about understanding the difference between caricature and satire.
Right. And that's why for this New Yorker cover to work, the people who are being satirized had to be on the cover.
They had to be in it, right? Exactly.
Had to be in it. And they're not.
Right.
And so instead, it is not satire. It is a caricature. And
right.
And it, just like, a black guy with exaggerated lips eating a watermelon is a caricature. I mean, And that, I mean, frankly, in my opinion, this falls into that category. And I just think it's a terrible mistake that the New Yorker has made. Be on record, 45 minutes past the hour.
The Tom Hartman Program.
This is the Tom Hartman Program. Larger every day. I heard an explanation on the radio today. Rush Limbaugh has a theory that blows them all away. And Rush is right, or so he claims. And this is what he says.
Global warming is all caused by cow farts.
Sure is lots of cow.
Trust me. 9.5 minutes before the hour of the Tom Hartman Program, brought to you in part by the Teamsters, fighting to pass the Employee Free Choice Act. Find out more over at Teamster.org. 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number. And Jivan in Chicago, Illinois, and also in our chat room. Hey, Jivan.
Hey, how you doing, Tom? Nice to hear from you again and see you on the Tom Visionaire. But my point is, let me get to it, is the way that, the satire about Barack in the robe I kind of get now. The part that bothers me the most is the way they have his wife dressed up, because this backs up all the Fox talking points in regards to, let's say, militant, angry, this black woman, the way they did her hair, which she doesn't even wear hair like that, This and this, the terrorist fist bump, this backs up all of the Fox talking points and gives them more fodder to continue their assault on her, which actually is like it's a punch, indirect punch at Obama and his wife to, discredit them from getting into the White House, and keep people from voting for him. It's just really sickening. And as a black person, and I talked to many, even my mom and all them, and the way they see it is, it's just so ugly and degrading. It's amazing. So,
yeah. See, that's my point. Well said. Thank you, Jivan. I appreciate the call. I mean, it's without the context, without the people it made fun of in the picture, it doesn't work. Mary in Phoenix, Arizona. Hey, Mary.
Hi. That's exactly what I wanted to add on to. Mm-hmm. The gentleman who talked about not having the people in the picture.
Right.
Why not have the picture that the cartoon as drawn, but that's a computer monitor that some ignoramus is looking at?
Exactly.
That would make sense.
Yeah, then it's satire, and you're making that. Then you know who you're making fun of. You're making fun of the person watching the monitor, or
exactly,
or Limbaugh, or Karl Rove painting a painting, and drawing the cartoon, and you see them drawing the cartoon. And so you get it. We're making fun of the people who believe this, or we're making fun of the people who are peddling this. But instead,
exactly,
they're not doing that. They're missing from the picture. Thank you, Mary. Very, very well said. This Carl in Columbus, Ohio. Hey, Carl.
Hi, Tom. How is Professor Hartman today?
Fine, thank you.
I have been tweaked by this satire lie. And I looked it up in my Webster's Unabridged, and the answer is an ancient Roman commentary in verse on some prevailing vice or folly.
Mm-hmm.
So nothing depicted on the New Yorker magazine cover is Obama or Michelle's vice or folly.
Right.
Therefore, it is, by definition, according to Webster's, it is not satire.
No, it is, in effect, slander.
Yes.
Yeah.
And I would like to thank you for the work that you're doing as one of the Fantastic Four superheroes on radio. You, Mike Malloy, Randy Rhodes, and John Elliott are my window on the truth.
Well, thank you, Carl. That's good company to be in.
Could I ask one favor for the future?
Sure.
Quick one. Last time I talked to you was over a year ago. Our local affiliate is not carrying your show in prime time.
Mm-hmm.
And I do know who John Galt is, and you might give me a moment in the future to address that. Thank you for having the Rand Institute people on.
Okay, you're welcome, Carl. Yeah, John Galt, of course, the hero of Atlas Shrugged.
Thank you.
Good to hear from you, Carl. I appreciate the call. And sometime when we're on that topic, give us a shout. Lynn in Oakland, California, listening on Green 960. Hey, Lynn, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I'm going to be a fangirl for a minute and just say that I just love your show. I feel so much smarter in listening.
Thank you, Lynn.
But the point that I wanted to make was, I don't know if you heard about this also, that McLaughlin on his show this weekend called Obama an Oreo.
Yeah, I saw it, actually. Yeah.
I think that, honestly, this New Yorker cover, the Oreo joke, the Times article about, you know, the late night host being unable to find a way to make jokes about Obama or satirize Obama. You know what? Why don't they just hire more black writers?
I think there's a larger reality here, Lynn, and that is that it's becoming acceptable to be racist.
Absolutely. And honestly, I think it's, you know, the private conversations that you know, so-called liberals are having, maybe you're not necessarily as liberal as you thought you were. I mean, you know, have you checked in with your one black friend or whatever and kind of...
Well, that's where Colbert does a good, you know, Colbert with his, you know, his black friend. I mean, that's good satire.
Exactly. It's good satire. But you know what? Just like you said earlier, in good satire, there's a grain of truth. Check in with your one black friend. Maybe, just maybe, what you're saying is a tiny bit racist. That McLaughlin comment, when I saw it posted on the web yesterday, I read the comments from the people who watched the video. It was amazing to me that the reaction actually was, well, how come it's okay for them to say those words and not okay for us to say those words? Really? Is that where we really are in the 21st century, that we're still going to argue about what words it is and isn't okay for people to say? It's not okay to say any of those words, and that's really the point. Get some more diversity in your offices and in your writers' rooms, and you won't get in trouble, you won't get boycotted, and you won't have these issues anymore.
Well, and the one point that misses is that people who are suffering oppression, and, you know, granted, things are getting better, but we're not there yet.
No.
People who are systematically harmed or discriminated against, whether it's Native Americans or African Americans or whatever it may be, they can speak of that in a way that if the oppressors speak of it, it's a completely different story.
Right.
It has a completely different meaning. And that's being lost in the name of political correctness, and that's the kind of stuff that the right would like to do away with. Anyhow, Lynn, thank you very much for the call. I appreciate it.
Good to hear from you.
57 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman Program. Coming up next, Dan Gaynor going to tell us how wonderful the economy is.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
The Tom Hartman Program, where smart people get their news.
Listening to Tom Hartman.
The Tom Hartman Program.
The true people's radio.
This is Tom Hartman.
I haven't figured it out by now. They have to tell us three times. I don't know. Well, anyhow, welcome back. It's to the second hour of our program. Dan Gaynor is with us. He's the T. Boone Pickens Fellow and the Vice President of the Business and Media Institute. Also a veteran editor with more than two decades' experience in print and online media. Business and Media, that's spelled out, andmedia.org is the website. The T. Boone Pickens Fellow. Dan, first of all, welcome to the show.
Oh, it's a pleasure to be back. How are you doing today?
Just fine. T. Boone Pickens, an interesting character. On the one hand, he funded the major funder of the Swift Boat Veterans for Truth. On the other hand, he's running around now, he's going to make some money with wind power and taking on the oil industry,
I mean, I think Boone realizes something that I think any good businessman would, is that we need a lot more energy. And I talked a while back, one of the things I think you and I agreed on, it's like, you know, the reality is we need more energy. I'm pretty neutral on, I think we need energy across the board. The president said you can drill offshore, that's great. that doesn't solve the problem. I think a lot of things everybody's talking about are stopgap measures.
Right.
So Boone's trying to talk long term.
I agree, and I don't disagree with that at all. Today, but that's not the topic we're going to talk about today. We've only got a few minutes. Ben Bernanke today would not use the recession word. He, in his testimony, the New York Times characterized it as a gloomy assessment, but he used phrases like sluggish pace and housing sector continues to weaken. But you look at the headlines out there, and it's like, WaMu and National City plummet, shares of the troubled banks plunge 30%, banking crisis looms. What we have here now, just since George Bush became president, over 5 million people have slipped into poverty, 7 million Americans have lost their health insurance, the median household income has gone down in inflation and adjusted dollars by $1,300 per family, 3 million American jobs have been lost, 3 million American workers have lost their pensions. Home foreclosures are at a rate that we haven't seen since the Great Depression. This personal savings rate is below zero, something that hasn't happened since the Great Depression. The real earnings of college graduates are down by 5% since Bush came into office. Entry-level wages for male and female high school graduates have fallen over 3% since Bush came into office. And wages and salaries are now at the lowest share of GDP since 1929. This is post-crash 1929. And you're writing that we're just a nation of whiners.
No, actually, I'm not writing that we're a nation of whiners. Phil Graham came out and said the nation of whiners comment. But what's funny?
No, you're saying that I've got your article here from Investors Business Daily, and you say one of the hardest things for reporters to do is distance themselves when they become part of the story. That's precisely the problem with journalists covering the U.S. economy, because the journalism industry is in chaos. And you don't use the phrase nation of whiners, but basically, instead of my characterizing what you're saying, you can say it.
Well, what I've been saying is, some of the stuff you said, certainly I'm not a big Bush defender, so I'm not going to disagree that we're in a difficult time. I'm going to agree with Ben Bernanke, though, and say to call a recession, which the media have been doing for years. I mean, they started calling a recession a couple of years ago, and they've been consistently wrong. They're still consistently wrong because not only, the first quarter growth numbers got ramped up, not down. So they've been using the same definition for years, what a recession is, what it's not, and then when they don't get the results, they want to change the field of play.
But, Dan, the bottom line is that from...
The bottom line is their outlook in the world, and I say this as a career journalist, their outlook in the world is that the media world is collapsing, just spiraling into the pit. Their friends, their coworkers, their own jobs are in jeopardy. And so that affects how they write.
Today we had the publisher of the Los Angeles Times resign. A couple days ago, the publisher of the Chicago Tribune is resigning. I mean, because the new owner, Zell is his name or whatever his name is.
Yeah.
Is saying, okay, you got to cut salaries, you got to cut reporters. We're gonna cut pages, we're gonna cut everything. We're gonna make some money on this because he's got in order to buy all these newspapers, he had to borrow a pile of money and he's got to pay off the debt. I mean, this is the classic pump and dump. Buy it on credit and then strip it down. This is how Mitt Romney made his millions. It makes millions of dollars for guys at the top and it screws everybody else. And it's happening now in the journalism industry, just like it is in pretty much it has been over the last 30 years. Every other industry across America.
Well,
the bottom line is that when we had liberal economic policies by liberals like Dwight Eisenhower from the 1940s, from really the late 1930s up until the 1980s, we had steady and consistent growth, and this nation became the industrial powerhouse of the world. We were the world's leading exporter of finished goods, the world's leading supplier of credit and money to the rest of the world, the largest creditor in the world. We have now, in 30 years of Reaganomics, 30 years of these insane economic policies, which were pursued by Bill Clinton as well, by the way, even though he didn't campaign on that in 92, he governed that way after Robert Rubin and Alan Greenspan and sat him down 2 weeks before he was installed into office and took the oath of office. And 30 years of this stuff has caused us now to see real wages over the last 30 years decline. Social mobility is at a point, the ability of middle class people to become wealthy or poor people to become middle class is at a point we haven't seen since 1905.
You're blaming Reaganism for
I am.
Reality. The reality is we live in a global economy. We live in a global economy unlike anybody.
We have always lived in a global economy. The British East India Company thought we lived in a global economy, and the American colonists, you know, said, you guys can get out of here.
You know, when you can go to the food store and get your food that's, I mean, current food, fresh food, that's come from South America, well, you can go on the Internet, and I can compete with a news organization by hiring five kids fresh out of Columbia Journalism School and pay them one-third of what, or one-half of what they're getting paid at a daily newspaper, well, then that's pretty
easy. Or you can hire five journalists in India and pay them two or 5% of what Americans would be paid. And by the way, that's happening.
Yeah, it's happened to a couple organizations. You lose some local know-how, though. And what the irony is, some of the complaints about the cheap dollar is actually bringing a lot of jobs back. People like Hollywood, they're building, you know, they're doing more productions now back in the United States.
No, but this is a stupid way to run an economy, to say we're going to use monetary policy, we're going to make America poorer, and we're going to use our poverty as a way of getting wealthier countries to come here. It's like monetary policy should not replace rational trade policy. For 200 years,
by
we
that,
had...
I guess you mean restrictive trade policy.
We had tariffs in the United States starting in 1787 that ran right up until the 1980s that averaged throughout that entire period between 30% and 40% throughout the entire period. And it built America as the biggest industrial superpower of the world. 100% of the federal budget from the founding of this country until the Civil War came from tariffs. Two-thirds of the federal budget from the Civil War to World War I came from tariffs. Fully a third of the federal budget, and this was a time when the size of the federal government tripled from World War I to World War II, fully a third of the budget came from tariffs. And when Reagan came into office, the average import tariff into the United States was around 23%. Right now, it's 2%. We have stripped all of our defenses away. We've taken away the membrane, the skin, the economic skin that protected us. But we're trying to maintain the border skin. We're saying we need to stop people, but let's not stop multinational corporations.
We're legally obligated by World Trade Organization and other agreements, NAFTA and stuff like that, to, you know, to not have these tariffs.
Right, we signed these treaties, and just like Bush unsigned the strategic missile treaty, we can unsign these treaties. We can walk away from them.
So you basically are advocating Fortress America.
I am suggesting that we do the same thing that China is doing. China says if you want to import a General Motors car into China, that's a 21% tariff. We say if you want to import a Chinese car into the United States, it's a 2% tariff. Tell me what's wrong with that picture.
Well, no. See, now, okay, there we're going to find some agreement. I'm going to say that China is breaking the rules, and that is part.
China
of
is ignoring the rules.
Yeah, that China, Japan,
and so does Korea,
countries.
And so does Japan, and so does basically every other economy that works.
Well, not every other economy. There are countries, but the countries who are obeying the rules are getting screwed. To use your book title, disagree with that. So then then it's up to whoever the next president is, because this president and this Congress, and the last president and the last Congress, and everybody in between have not held them to those rules. Part of the constructive engagement with China.
Dan, this is an experiment that's failing.
What was that?
It's an experiment that's failing.
Well, it's failing only because people aren't playing by the rules. So you're holding to the rules. With China, China's not going to want to lose the world, you know, this enormous market has, but it's getting away with not obeying rules. Same with Japan.
Okay.
There's a
so
reason why
we need more free trade.
Japan.
More free trade. Okay.
Everybody obeys the rules.
Yeah, okay. Businessandmedia.org, the website. Dan Gaynor. Dan, thanks for dropping by.
Always a pleasure.
16 minutes past the hour.
This is Tom Hartman.
The Tom Hartman Program.
Truth in Broadcasting.
Your faith is broken.
past the hour. So the folks over at the Business and Media Institute are suggesting that really the press, and this is the essence of Dan's article, that the press is all upset about the economy because the press itself is being downsized, and therefore, of course, they're now very concerned. By the way, What Now Tunes, the cartoon we've got up at the top of TomHartmann.com. If you want to drop in and say hi to Keith, he's in our chat room. Hey, Keith, how you doing? Anyhow, as I was saying, what was I saying? Oh, yeah. The suggestion is being made by these folks that, you know, it's really not a recession. It's really not a depression. There's really nothing to worry about. The economy's just fine. Don't worry at all. And so I thought, you know, let's look at some similar voices from the past. This is E.H.H. Simmons, the president of the New York Stock Exchange. In 1928, he says, "I cannot help but raise a dissenting voice to statements that we are living in a fool's paradise and that prosperity in this country must necessarily diminish and recede in the near future." See, people were very concerned in 1928 because there was a housing bubble that burst in 1927, and it was starting to take the country down. Took about 2 years. It first burst in Florida. Irving Fisher, the United States' leading economist, in the New York Times, September 5th, 1929. There may be a recession in stock prices, but not anything in the nature of a crash. October 17th, 1929, Irving Fisher, Ph.D. in economics. "Stock prices have reached what looks like a permanently high plateau. I do not feel that there will be soon, if ever, a 50 or 60-point break from present levels, such as the bears have predicted. I expect to see the stock market a good deal higher within a few months." And then the day after the crash, Arthur Reynolds, chairman of the Continental Illinois Bank of Chicago, he says the crash is not going to have much effect on business. Goodbody and Company, their market letter, quoted in the New York Times. This was one of the leading stock market suggesting letters. This is October 25th, 1929. "We feel that fundamentally Wall Street is sound and that for people who can afford to pay for them outright, good stocks are cheap at these prices." Another market analyst quoted in the New York Herald on October 30th, 1929, 2 days after the crash, 3-4 days after the crash. "This is the time to buy stocks. This is the time to recall the words of the late J.P. Morgan, that any man who is bearish on America will go broke. That in a few days there's likely to be a bear panic rather than a bull panic. Many of the low prices as a result of this hysterical selling are not likely to be reached again in many years." R.W. Neal in October 1929, financial analyst. Some pretty intelligent people are now buying stocks. No one seriously believes stocks have hit bottom. And on it goes. I mean, it's just, I could give you all these quotes. Herbert Hoover. You know, the president of the United States is, you know, goes on. In fact, you know, so one of his more famous quotes is, "It is not the function of government to relieve individuals of their responsibilities to their neighbors or to relieve private institutions of their responsibilities to the public." See, this is that war of ideas. Prior to the 1930s, one of the main memes, one of the main ideas that was held in the United States and across the world is that the role of government was to protect the commons and to protect a national interest, but not to protect the average person outside of police and fire. And even that was debated. I mean, there were places that had private police departments and private fire departments. And from the 1930s until the 1980s, we redefined the role of government in the United States. And we said, no, the role of government is actually to act in the interests of all the people in the nation. Whether it's through trade policy, whether it's through Social Security, whether it's through some sort of a national health care program. The United States is the only industrialized country that didn't adopt that. Whether it's through unionization, making, you know, facilitating unionization so that workers have rights. All of these things, making sure that there's at least some minimal standard of education nationwide. All of these things are the things that are the appropriate role of government. And then along came Reagan. Actually, he was preceded by about 15 years by hundreds of millions of dollars, arguably billions in today's dollars, being poured into right-wing think tanks by very, very wealthy individuals and corporations, trying to change the way that Americans thought about the concept of freedom. What is freedom? We had always thought that freedom meant that government was providing the soil in which freedom could grow. And then along came the Grover Norquist of the world, and they said, no. Freedom is not having a government. It's having a government that's so small you can drown it in a bathtub. And so government shouldn't protect industries with things like tariffs. Government shouldn't protect individuals with things like unemployment insurance. And government shouldn't protect the elderly and the disabled with things like Social Security. Those are not the appropriate roles of government, because that's not freedom. And Reagan promulgated that myth, and that has been the dominant. People actually believe that, by and large. I'd say the majority of Americans have bought in to that libertarian, conservative view of economics since from the 1980s. And in fact, it is such a radical experiment. It has gone so radical that it even surpasses anything that ever preceded it. I mean, we're even to the point now where we're willing to throw out habeas corpus, which goes back to 1215.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Give us a call at 866-303-2270.
I'm telling you, this is the leading edge of it, not the trailing edge of it, this whole economic disaster. By the way, just a couple of notes of things coming up. July 18th, this Friday, is it 4 days hence, I will be in Grand Rapids, Michigan. We'll be doing the show from WTKG, and then from 6:30 to 7:30 Friday night, there'll be a book signing and buffet dinner, courtesy of Lanning's Catering at the UAW Regional Offices. That's at East Beltline Avenue Northeast and Leonard Street Northeast in Grand Rapids. You can find information, the address and all that kind of stuff over at tomhartman.com on our calendar. And also, on August 16th, I'll be at the Seattle Center Exhibition Hall. Progressive Talk AM 1090 KPTK is putting on We the People, a town hall forum. And the moderator will be Ron Reagan. And the participants will be me, Stephanie Miller, Rachel Maddow, Randy Rhodes, Mike Malloy, and Sam Cedar. So it should be a lot of fun. And they are selling tickets to that one. They're selling fast. AM1090Seattle.com is the website. So if you want to pick up tickets for that gig. There are no tickets necessary for the one in Grand Rapids. It's free. Free food even. So it should be a lot of fun. Back to this, what we are seeing here is the failure of Reaganomics. We're seeing the failure of supply-side economics. We're seeing the failure of this bizarre idea that if you cut the taxes on the very, very rich and raise taxes on everybody else, which is what Reagan did. He doubled the taxes on working people, and he cut from 71% down to 27% of the taxes on millionaires and billionaires. And you know, now Bush has dropped down to 15% the taxes on capital gains, people who make money on money. And by the way, there's a great video of this also on our website at tomhartman.com. I put it up there yesterday. It's attached to yesterday's show blog. It's just a little YouTube video that shows, you know, over a 40-year period, let's look at what happens when you cut taxes. You cut corporate taxes, you cut taxes on the rich, and you cut taxes, you know, top marginal tax rates, and you cut taxes on people who make their money with money. In other words, capital gains and dividends. And what we see is that unemployment goes up and GDP, the actual productivity of the economy, goes down. So we are now seeing the consequences of 30 years of Reaganomics, 30 years of Tom Friedman's flat world, 30 years of Milton Friedman's everybody for themselves, Friedrich von Hayek's notion of neoliberalism, what we refer to in the United States as conservative economics or Reaganomics, Thatcherism. And what we're seeing is the destruction of our economy. And I'm telling you, this IndyMac bank, this is just the beginning. people say, well, you know, what can I do? I mean, there are thousands of people, possibly tens of thousands of people, who are only going, you know, who had more than $100,000 in that bank. Many of them, their entire retirement savings, their life savings, and they're only going to get $100,000, which was a lot of money, you know, back 20, 30, 40, 50 years ago when that threshold was set, whenever it was set for the FDIC. But it ain't a lot of money today if you got to live the rest of your life on it. Even if you have to live a couple of years on it, it's not a lot of money today. There is a scheme to get around this that the small banks of America have put together. I find this fascinating. It's called CDARS, Certificate of Deposit Account Registry Service. The website is CDARS.com, CDARS.com. And there's a little explanation there. And basically what you do is you go to your local bank, and most of the member banks, in fact, I think all of the member banks, are not the big banks. They're the smaller regional banks. You go to your local bank and you say, I've got more than $100,000 in my fill-in-the-blank, you know, in my account. And, or it's, I guess it's $250,000 if it's a 401k. But in any case, you say, I've got more than $100,000 and I want to put it into CDs and I want to spread it around over a bunch of banks. So say you got $500,000, you know, and you want to distribute it. So you give it to this one bank and you sign a CDAR form, CDARS.com. You sign a CDAR form. And what they do is they have reciprocal deals with a whole bunch of other small banks, all of them FDIC insured. And so they take that $500,000 and they make six deposits with six banks, because it wouldn't do $100,000 each, because then the interest is going to push up above that as they earn. So they make five $90,000 deposits and one $50,000 deposit with six different banks. And you now have six federally insured up to $100,000 deposits. So it's one way around it. I mean, you know, if you want to put your money into CDs, I mean, this, people are, I think, rightly very concerned. We're going to see more banks fail, in my opinion, and we're going to see investment houses. I mean, I think this is the beginning, not the end. And it is going to get worse. 866-303-2270, our telephone number. And Dwayne in Sonoma County, California. Hey, Dwayne, what's up?
Tom, I find you absolutely right about the economy and what you say. But I think you give away half the game when you refer to NAFTA as a treaty.
Why is that?
Well, because it didn't get the two-thirds vote in the Senate required to pass a treaty.
Oh, yeah, okay, you're right. It's not a treaty. It's a trade agreement.
And there's no provision in the U.S. Constitution to pass agreements.
Right, and well, and beyond that, because it's not a treaty, it doesn't have the force of law inside the United States.
Mm-hmm.
Right? The Constitution says that treaties supersede laws passed by Congress. But you're right. If NAFTA was not ratified by two-thirds of the House and Senate, then it's not. It's spot on. That's a good take, Dwayne. Thank you very much. Well said. This is incredible what's going on. James and Eugene. Hey, James.
Hey, I'm calling about the NCUA and the difference between credit unions and banks.
Yeah.
Credit unions are non-for-profit organizations that are insured by the NCUA, an organization that has never had to pay out a single dime.
Insured to, and your deposits are insured to how much?
Up to $100,000 per person in three categories. Individual, all accounts with individual ownership are up to $100,000 per person, not per account, per person. All accounts with joint ownership are $100,000 per person. So if you have a joint and a primary, that's two people, you could be $100,000 per person in that category. There's a third category, payable on death. That's up to $100,000 per the divided by the primary owners and all of the beneficiaries.
Yeah. So don't overlook your credit unions as well.
Don't overlook credit unions. Put all your eggs in more than one basket. IRAs are handled separately. With the NCUA, they're insured up to $250,000.
Right. Okay. James, thank you very much. I appreciate the tip. Prez in Santa Rosa, California. Hey, Prez.
Good morning, Tom.
Good morning.
I just wanted to say that this is just a con game. And you're exactly right. It's just a shame that that doesn't happen more frequently, so more people be able to see it instead of all a new generation.
Well, it takes a generation for people to forget how they'd been conned the last time by the Phil Grahams of the world.
Yeah, and these guys are nothing more than thieves. They're basically thieves. They're completing the looting. They have such a short-term low road mentality. They're small people.
Yeah.
And
well,
just,
and see, but that has been elevated. I mean, what Reagan came along and said, and this goes back to the game theory and the thinking in the 1950s, and you know, in fact, psychiatry was even embracing this. Certainly, the economists did, the Milton Friedmans of the world, is that people are only interested in themselves, that's a good thing, and that you want to harness the power of greed. And the fact of the matter is that people actually are altruistic. People actually do care about community and about each other. And people, you know, only psychopaths and economists will behave in a way that is consistent exclusively with their own self-interest. And all the rest of us actually do believe in public service and actually, but what's happened is that the Republicans particularly, I mean, you see this writ large in the Bush administration. I mean, all these people who go into government and then as soon as they leave government, boom, they're making piles of money. Government was a means to making piles of money. And it used to be that government service was something that people did with their lifetimes. It was service. It was literally service because they believed in service. And we have devastated that belief system.
Yeah.
We've ridiculed it and we've said, no, that's wrong and that's not how it works. Now, Press, you're spot on and very well said. Sean in Vancouver, Washington. Hey, Sean.
Tom, I was wondering if you could help me. I don't really know my New York geography, but I was wondering how far is it from the floor of that hospital in New York where the woman spent an hour on the floor dying from the floor of the New York Stock Exchange where there was tons of intervention on the behalf of the super rich?
Yeah, damn good question, Sean. That's a very elegant way to frame it, a very, very elegant way to frame it. Well done. Steve in Los Angeles. Hey, Steve.
Tom, first of all, you are my hero. And secondly, and more to the point, this is a rhetorical question, and it may seem like a strange question, but I'd like your take on it. I'm beginning to wonder what anybody in this country really has in common. In David McCullough's very fine biography of John Adams, he has Adams saying, in essence, that a democracy can only last so long. It becomes so diverse that it tears itself apart. So my question becomes, I mean, I look at California. It's like a country disguised as a state.
Yeah.
How long does this all hold together, or do we go the way of the Soviet Union, maybe breaking up into four separate countries?
Well, that's a really,
that may sound
that's a really good question, Steve. No, a lot of people have asked it. And I don't know if you've back a decade or so ago, there was a book called The Seven Nations of America, as I recall.
Yeah.
And the author identified, you know, the Rust Belt and the Farm Belt and the Tex-Mex. And he had names for all these different regions of the United States. And he pointed out that they were all culturally different. They had different languages and things like that. I think that we can be a diverse nation. I really do. I think it can work. 45 minutes past the hour.
Tom Hartman.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Before 866-303-2270, our telephone number, and yeah, that's a great one. Oh man, let's see here. Jeff in Denver, Colorado. Hey, Jeff.
Anyone with basic math skills could have predicted what's going on with us economically now. I mean, many of us did predict it in the early 1980s.
I was predicting it when Reagan came into office and said, "Hey, I got this great idea. Look at this Lafleur curve," and I'm going, "What?"
Yeah, well, we need to pay attention to, well, we're ignoring the elephant herd in the room, and that's military spending. We've been spending anywhere from 40% more on our military budget, of discretionary spending, of our budget on the military, for decades now. And the thing is, it's like, hey, we've got more military bases than there are countries in the world.
Yeah.
And when we're spending
We spend more on our military than every other country's military spending in the world combined.
So, A couple things. First of all, Jefferson didn't believe in a standing army, so how are these, like when libertarians say our only, you know, role of government is to defend us, well, that didn't seem to be Jefferson's.
Right. Nope. We lost Jeff. Somehow. Let's try.
Military.
There you go. You're back on. Jeff, I'm sorry. Somehow you got put on hold.
Okay. Well, anyway, I don't know if you heard the thing that this would not be Jefferson's idea since he didn't believe in a standing army.
No, absolutely.
But if we've got this much need for a military, doesn't it say there's something fundamentally wrong with us, that we need to reexamine something else? First of all, I don't think we do have that need. It's more just a thing to make money. But
yeah, this is what Eisenhower warned about, is the military-industrial congressional complex.
But I want to hear people like Obama start talking about slashing the military budget.
I do, too, and you're not going to hear it during the campaign. He's either going to do it as president or not. But I guarantee you, if he were to talk like that during the campaign, it would be a candidacy killer.
Yeah, another way we need to get to look at and getting out of this is with all their energy projects people are proposing right now, they're proposing things that get us stuck with monthly bills.
Right.
You know, people in the 1800s didn't have tons of monthly bills. We are stuck paying out money all our lives.
Right.
We could do personal power projects. Decentralized personal power is the way to go. Imagine a house where you pay no bill for anything other than, you know, taxes for the rest of your life.
Yeah, pump your own water out of the ground, generate your own electricity off your roof.
You cool your house by drawing up air from underground.
Yeah.
Just check the temperature of the water coming out of your faucet right now.
Yeah.
You can use that coolness of the ground to air condition your house. It's really easy.
Yeah, and they do in many countries, as a matter of fact.
Yeah, it's all so simple. And so it's just personal power and slash the military budget are two of the easy ways out of this.
Yeah, very well said. Jeff, thank you very much for the call, and thanks for pointing that out. It's very well said. Scott in Virginia Beach, Virginia. Hey, Scott.
Hi, Tom. What I called about was something I heard Ross Perot say a long time ago, but I'm a disabled vet. That last call, the problem is not that our military is too big. We actually need a bigger military. The problem is this making it privatized, all these civilians and stuff. We don't have enough guys in the military, and we spend way too much on way too few guys in things like Halliburton and what is this, Blackwater and stuff like that.
Yeah, and way too much on crazy technology like Star Wars.
Oh,
I mean,
yeah.
You know, Reagan spent over $1 trillion on this boondog.
But as far as number, okay, but what I was going to say about in 92, the only time a third-party candidate really had a chance to win the election before he dropped out and come back with Perot, he told us exactly what was going to happen, from lobbyist power to jobs being lost to inflation to borrow money from China. Why doesn't anybody ask him what the heck's going on? To me, it seems like, you know, Obama doesn't seem like a guy that's going to fight corporations. He's going so far to the center, it's not even funny. Edwards was the guy that, you know, might have had a chance, but it's almost like it's beyond hope now. It's 10 times worse than it was in 92, and we're not going fighting corporations. We're going to negotiate with them.
Yeah, and the problem that we had in 92 was that Bill Clinton, and you can go back and look at the footage of him talking before labor unions and whatnot, and Bill Clinton campaigned as a populist and as a progressive, and he was overwhelmingly elected as such. And then he governed as a conservative, as a Reaganite.
Obama's doing the same thing, except he's moving actually,
I would say no. I would say Obama failed us on the FISA Act, on the FISA bill. That was a huge failure. But by and large, most of the other so-called changes of his are actually not really changes. It's, you know, we'd been imagining what he had been saying, I'm not all that concerned about it. My take on this, Scott, is that we need to be an organized pressure on him. There was, you know, when Clinton changed his policies after he became president and didn't follow through on the things that he promised as his campaign. Nobody held his feet to the fire. Nobody was pointing it out. Everybody was just, you know, hey, everything's fine. You know, it's finally there's a Democrat in the White House. You know, blah. We need to keep these guys accountable. We need to do everything we can to get as many Democrats elected as possible and then not sit back. Then get involved and get actually more involved and participate in these things. Ellen in Shelburne Falls, Massachusetts. Hey, Ellen.
Hi. I would like to go back for a minute to the speaker you had who talked about the fact that we live in a global economy. We're not going back. It's too late. And I hear you speaking a lot about protecting our nation's economy. But what we could work on is being sure that in these global agreements, these trade agreements, that the workers' rights, the ability to unionize, human rights are part of trade agreements. I think.
Yeah, but here's the problem, Ellen.
Yeah, what's the problem?
If you've got somebody in China who's making 30 cents an hour right now, and a living wage in China is, say, a dollar an hour, and they get a union, and they a real union, and they negotiate a dollar an hour plus benefits. So now they're working for, you know, an actual cost of maybe a buck and a half an hour.
Yeah, I understand.
How is that going to help the American who really needs to have $15, $18, $20 an hour in order to have a decent income, arguably $25 or $30 an hour if they're going to a single wage earner who's trying to raise a family?
Right, but I think that we need to be realistic, and maybe China is not the place where it would work, but there are South American countries and other...
What's going to happen is as long...
This issue. Don't let that die.
I'm not. But my point is we can't, and thank you for the call, Ellen, we can't simply give in and say, no, Tom Friedman and his flat world and all that stuff is right and it's inevitable and we're simply going to... He's wrong. Tom Friedman is wrong. He's speaking to the interest of the billionaires like himself. 57 minutes past the hour. Naomi Klein up next.
The Tom Hartman Program.
News without conflicts of global corporate interest.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Listening to Tom Hartman.
The Tom Hartman Program.
News without conflicts of global corporate interest.
This is Tom Hartman.
Yeah, I guess we figured that out. 6 minutes past the hour. Welcome back. Naomi Klein is on the line with us, the award-winning journalist, syndicated columnist, author of the New York Times and international bestseller, The Shock Doctrine, The Rise of Disaster Capitalism. Naomi, welcome back to the program. Naomi?
Yes.
Hey, welcome back.
Great to be with you again.
Great to have you back with us. You have participated, you have joined with The Nation magazine and the ACLU in this lawsuit over this new evisceration of the FISA statutes, I guess would be how I would characterize it. If you want to characterize it a different way, please do so. Pardon?
That's good.
Okay. And tell us about this.
Yeah, well, the ACLU has been working on this for several months. They brought together a coalition of people who, for their work, need to be able to have secure communications across borders. So there are people who work with human rights organizations, with women's organizations, and journalists like us at The Nation. We're named as complainants in the suit, and Chris Hedges and I are the two people representing The Nation.
Mm-hmm.
But these are everybody who's involved in the lawsuit needs to be able to make phone calls, send emails with people who trust that there's some security in these communications. Obviously, for journalists, we need to protect our sources. For human rights workers, they may need to communicate with somebody in Afghanistan who provided them testimony on the condition that they not be named. And what the new bill does is it says that as long as you're not an American, as long as they can show that somebody in the United States is communicating with somebody not in the United States, then the very fact of their not being in the United States gives them the right to put that communication under surveillance, whether it's email, whether it's a phone call, to hold on to those records indefinitely. They don't need to prove that the person you're talking to is a suspected terrorist. They just need to prove that that person is not an American.
Right, and the Fourth Amendment clearly says that you have to have probable cause before you can search somebody's person's papers or effects, probable cause that a crime is being committed.
Yeah, and that applies to American citizens, but it does not apply to American citizens when they are communicating with people outside of America who are not citizens and not protected by these rights.
Under this new law. Right.
So the ACLU had been preparing this lawsuit for many months, hoping that they wouldn't have to launch it, hoping that Congress and the Senate would defeat this law. That didn't happen, and as soon as President Bush signed it, the ACLU filed the case. I'm one of the complainants, and I think it's really the ACLU at its best, defending the law when the lawmakers don't.
Well, and in fact, the day that George Bush signed the law, we had one of the spokespersons for the ACLU on the program talking about that. And this is just an absolute disaster to step off the title of your book.
Well, you know, I have to say, just add that I actually find it surprising that more mainstream journalists and news organizations aren't adding their voices. Because having secure communications is part of all of our work,
and it would have
been nice to have some stronger support from bigger news organizations.
Is it possible at this point to participate? For example, I mean, I've done this show in March. I did this show for a week from Darfur, or from the border with Darfur, from southern Sudan, and we had a lot of communications to set that thing up. I did this show last month from Denmark. We're going to be doing it in November from Germany. I also, for 30 years, have been have done volunteer work for an international relief agency based in Germany, and I communicate with them virtually every week and have for almost 30 years. I've set up hospitals in Africa and in South America. We took over leper colonies and orphanages in India. I mean, I have personally done those things around the world and continue to be involved in these things, and I'm on the board of this organization that's based out of another country, based out of Germany. And you know, I would love to participate in this lawsuit, and perhaps Air America would want to. Obviously, we're not the we're not the New York Times, which is what I think you're talking about. You know, why isn't the New York Times involved in this? But is there still a window open for people to say, I would like to be a co-complainant in this?
I think there probably is, and they should contact. There's lots of ways that they can add their names to this lawsuit, and I think the ACLU is really committed to keeping this alive. Despite the failure of the lawmakers, and it's really crucial that we do so. And you know, one of the things that I think is really important to remember in this moment, where people are talking about undoing the damage of the Bush years, is we talk about the rights of Americans, the rights of Americans to privacy, but there's a real message of contempt in this bill about anyone who is not an American. I happen to have dual citizenship, but the message of this bill is, if you're not an American, you have no rights whatsoever. And people outside of the United States are getting that message in a lot of ways. They don't have the right to habeas corpus in Guantanamo. They're treated depending on where they come from, with increasing contempt at the border. There's a lot of fear about ending up on these lists, and we just have been on these no-fly lists. So it's just another way that people outside the United States are being sent a very clear message from this country about their second-class citizenship.
Yeah, and the contempt that the United States, at least this administration, has for humans. I mean, at the core, humans.
Rights to privacy should actually not be attached to whether you're an American citizen.
Well, in the Constitution, they're not.
Under surveillance by the U.S. government without having to have any probable cause, probable cause, didn't vote for this administration. So in my view, they have more of a right not to be under surveillance.
Well, and in fact, if you read the Constitution, it refers to persons, not citizens. There are only a very few places in the Constitution where it refers to citizens, one being who can be a president of the United States, for example.
Mm-hmm. These are human rights.
Yeah, but by and large, the Constitution of the United States refers to persons, and it applies to, and the courts have ruled over and over and over again, it applies to people whether they're citizens or not. I mean, this was the Hamdan ruling. This whole collection of Guantanamo rulings is that these people are persons, and they happen to be in property which is under the control of the United States, even though it's outside the borders of the United States, and so they have rights.
And I mean, in terms of my work and why I feel very passionately about this, I mean, in terms of the book that I'm just launching right now, this is reporting that based on reporting all over the world, and including communications with people in Iraq who are in danger if they believe that their communications can just be hoovered up by the U.S. government.
Right.
So it's it's not an abstract issue.
Absolutely. We're talking with Naomi Klein, her new book, The Shock Doctrine, The Rise of Disaster Capitalism. Her website, naomiklein.org, the book debuting in paperback on the New York Times bestseller list. Naomi, we have about 2 minutes left. In that time, can you give us a thumbnail sketch of how the 30-year assault on the middle class by Reaganomics and supply-side economics has produced a shock that we're calling the banking crisis right now that is going to be exploited?
Well, I mean, we have a government that doesn't believe in governing, that believes in undoing. And what has passed for governing since Reagan is actually the dismantling of the government, the unmaking of structures, which with entirely predictable results. One thing that I think people, you know, in terms of the, launching the book in paperback, I'm really feeling that the book is more relevant in this political moment than it was when the book first came out in the fall, because we're facing this tsunami of crises, the oil shock, the food crisis, the subprime mortgage crisis, and we're watching in real time the Bush administration using each one of these shocks to push through what I'm just calling the shock doctrine, to push through unpopular policies that prey on people's fear, that prey on people's desire for short-term solutions. I mean, it's incredible the short time it took to move away from a discussion about alternative energy sources, about wind, solar, hybrids, and move towards a discussion of just reiterating the oil and gas industry's talking points. It's all we get when we turn on television right now, whether it's the paid ads or the pundits and anchors just repeating again and again that the way to lower gas at the pump is to drill offshore, is to drill in Anwar, is to do exploration in the shale, which is environmentally devastating. None of this is true. All of this would take between 5 and 10 years to get online. It's just the oil and gas industry using people's fear and their desire for a quick fix to change the subject.
Right. Plus, they already have leases that they're not drilling.
Well, look, they want those leases. They want more leases.
That's the whole point.
The more leases they control, the more they're able to control the supply, the more price fixing they can do. Not only won't this lower the price at the pump, but this actually gives the oil and gas industry much more power to artificially raise prices.
Right. So here the shock doctrine that was applied to the Soviet Union, the shock doctrine that was applied to Chile, privatized Social Security and everything else, the shock doctrine is being applied to us here in the United States as well. Naomi Klein, her book, The Shock Doctrine, The Rise of Disaster Capitalism, now out in paperback, or shortly out in paperback. Naomi, thanks so much for being with us.
So great to talk to you.
16 minutes past the hour.
The Tom Hartman Program.
Where despair is not an option.
Get active.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Until I get fired. Roger Schuller is with us. He worked 11 years for a daily newspaper, 18 years as university editor at the University of Alabama at Birmingham, UAB. He actually worked there 19 years, he says, on his blog, legalschnauzer.blogspot.com, and was apparently fired from his blog for blogging in support of Governor Don Siegelman, who's been a guest on this show 3, 4, maybe 5 times. I'm not sure which. And Roger, welcome to the program.
Tom, thank you. Appreciate you having me.
I think this is something everybody needs to know about. We'll have a link to it on our homepage at tomhartman.com, and of course your website for people who know how to spell Schnauzer, S-C-H-N-A-U-Z-E-R, is legalschnauzer.blogspot.com, and that'll get folks over there. We had a caller last hour asking, you know, America is so diverse. Is it possible that we are actually a whole bunch of different nations? And, you know, then the subtext was, you know, can we hold together as a country? We really are diverse. And Alabama, in many ways, seems to operate as its own separate little empire. I mean, apparently you were fired for blogging in defense of Don Siegelman and in offense of Lura Canary, the wife of Bill Canary, the campaign manager of Bob Riley, the guy who ran against Siegelman for governor of Alabama. And his wife is the prosecutor who prosecuted Don Siegelman. Do I have this right?
That's right. Tom, my blog really is about honest government. I vote Democratic, but I'm not an active member of a political organization. Mm-hmm. And yet, you know, I wound up getting fired essentially and accused of political activity at work.
Yeah, and in fact, your job at work involved having to keep up with the news and as an editor, I would assume.
That's right. Part of my job is to keep up with what's going on, particularly as it affects Alabama And so essentially I was fired for doing my job. I mean, as hard as that sounds to believe, and also I was accused of violating policies that really don't exist. We don't have a real clear policy regarding the use of the Internet, and I didn't abuse the Internet anyway. I was just doing part of my job, researching, keeping up with a story file, possible stories for our magazines that we do. And
right. You do your blogging from home, right? And you do your blogging from home on your own time.
I do it on my own time with my own equipment. And in UAB, I filed a grievance with the Employee Grievance Committee, and their own information technology guy admitted. He said this guy has never blogged on his work computer. So
now, in Alabama, when Don Siegelman first went on 60 Minutes, the television station there in Birmingham, during that 15-minute segment, suddenly went black. You know, they just, whoops, technical difficulties, first time in 100 years or whatever, but we couldn't play that. And then, you know, several hours later when everybody had gone to sleep, they played that clip with Siegelman so that they had aired it. To what extent is there, you know, an old boy network or a corrupt... I mean, here we have the federal prosecutor, Laura Canary, the wife of the guy who is the campaign manager for the current governor, Bob Riley, who only won when he ran against Don Siegelman, because in the middle of the night after Siegelman had been declared the winner, and only the Republican was left in the room with the electronic voting machine on the electronic tabulator, they suddenly discovered some extra votes for the Republican. I mean, it's just... bizarre, and then Don Siegelman complains about it, and he gets trashed by right-wing radio all over the state, and so he says, okay, what the heck, I'm going to run again, and they go after him on trumped-up charges. I mean, this is like something out of what I remember during the civil rights era in the 60s, you know, that kind of old Deep South, of a very insular, very corrupt society. Is it really that bad?
Well, it is in a way, Tom. There's a lot of good things to say about Alabama, but I really think the judicial problem that we have goes back to the 90s when Karl Rove and Bill Canary helped turn our appellate state courts from Democratic control over to Republican control.
Mm-hmm.
And Don Siegelman has used the term umbrella of protection that they have, that they can do just about anything they want because they control the Justice Department.
Yeah.
And I think he's right on target about that. I think they feel like no fear, and I think they have no fear about getting me fired. I think definitely people connected to the Republican Party in Alabama are the reason I got fired, and I'm researching that now and hope to have more details in the days ahead on my blog.
Right, good. And your blog is legalschnauzer.blogspot.com. We're talking with Roger Shuler, who was fired from the University of Alabama, apparently for talking about the Don Siegelman case. By the way, donsiegelman.org or .com will get you to I-before-E, Don Siegelman's website. He's still in need of contributions and moral support and help, so don't forget to go over there. So Roger, thank you so much for dropping by and sharing with us your story and everything that's going on. I'm assuming at legalschnauzer.blogspot.com there's information about how people can be supportive of you.
Yes, I've had, and I wanted to, Ross Story, who broke this story, they've done a wonderful job covering it, and
yeah, they have.
And I greatly appreciate the attention that they've given, not only to this, but the whole issue of the Bush Justice Department, and
yep.
I hope people really pay attention to it.
Absolutely agree. Larissa Alexandrovna and RawStory.com, they've done some really, really great work. Roger Shuler, LegalSchnauzer.blogspot.com, thanks for being with us.
Tom, thank you so much.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Call Tom at
866-303-2270.
24 minutes past the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And believe it or not, Phil Graham may be gone, but his porn lives on, as Max Blumenthal blogs over at Huffington Post. Yeah, his porn. Graham's journey into porn began in 1973 when his brother-in-law, George Catton, rushed to tell him about an exciting low-budget softcore production called Truck Stop Woman. The promo poster for the film boasted of its buxom stars. No rig was too big for them to handle. Catton showed Phil Graham scenes of Playboy Playmate of the Year Claudia Jennings displaying her bare essentials. She's naked throughout most of the film. Those scenes, his brother-in-law said, got Phil really titillated. Yeah. Graham enthusiastically wrote a check to help pay for the movie. Now, the following year, he sent another check to finance a movie, another softcore porn. This is about pageant judges having sex with contestants called Beauty Queens. And then finally, he funded a sequel, a satire on the Nixon White House called White House Madness, that featured the crazed president wandering around the White House in the nude. He never made any money on that, though. Shot 10 days in a soundstage crudely modeled after the Oval Office. White House Madness, Max Blumenthal writes over at the Huffington Post, tanked at the box office. So... What is that? Vermont spelled backwards is CIA. That's what Rama says in the chat room. It's a 866-303-2270 is our telephone number. Weldon in Minneapolis, Minnesota. Hey, Weldon, welcome to the show. What's on your mind today?
Hi, Tom. I just want to thank you for all that you do. But I'm at a point now where I'm thinking that talking is no longer viable. Doing is more viable than talking. And I'm just wondering, when do we start doing things?
Well, it depends on what you mean by doing.
I know you advocate for getting active via, you know, contacting congressmen, that type of thing.
Oh, I think we need to take it a whole step beyond that, Weldon. Typically, in most areas, I mean, you're in Minneapolis. It's a fairly large town, Minneapolis, St. Paul. There will be monthly meetings of the local Democratic Party, and there may be monthly meetings of the statewide Democratic Party. I mean,
At what point do we start advocating for national strikes and this type of thing?
I don't think, you know, I'd love to do it right now, but I don't think the national strikes are going to work. They're not going to succeed because the cons over 30 years have succeeded in so ripping apart the social fabric of this country and the economic fabric of this country that most people are, you know, they don't have the time, they don't have the ability to do a strike. Strikes work when you have a large organizing force. In France, you've got, you know, 50% of the workforce or whatever it is unionized. Here in the United States, it's only 7%.
I like your idea of people just going into the crosswalk and lying down.
Yeah,
you claim to have the ear of 3 million Americans. I would love to see 3 million Americans one day just all of a sudden all lie down in the crosswalk.
Yeah, so would I. I don't think that even if every progressive talk show host in the country were to get together and promote something like that, well, you never know. You never know. But I think that over the short term, there's a bunch of things that you can do to get active. There's drinking liberally, for example. I mean,
do you ever discuss these things with your progressive radio cohorts?
I do.
That's good.
I have. And in fact,
I'm glad to hear it because as long as somebody's talking about it, that's all I care about.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, Abut, are you Canadian, Weldon?
Yeah, I'm originally from Canada.
I caught you. Well, good on you for coming to the United States. Sean, my producer, Sean Taylor, she's actually still Canadian.
I still haven't mastered the Margie Wisconsin accent. Yet,
yeah,
though.
There you go. Okay. Well, Weldon, thanks a lot for the call. I appreciate it. And let me say again, there's a lot that people can do to get active. And number one, infiltrate and take over the Democratic Party. Number two, show up for the Green Party meetings as well. Being supportive of and active in the Democratic Party doesn't mean you can't also be active in the Green Party, which is a great local force. The most instant runoff voting, over 300 communities now in the United States, has all came about as a result of Green Party activism. Join local groups. Democracy for America, Howard Dean's brother's group, Jim Dean's group, democracyforamerica.com. They have local meetings. They've got these really great activist training programs that they do. It's a weekend long thing. It's like $30, $29, and usually typically even includes lunch. I mean, it's just they're marvelous. I've spoken at several of them. There's no shortage of groups and meetups and the drinking liberally groups, and in New York City there's even a screening liberally group, looking at movies and things. So there's a lot that can be done at a relatively small level with a relatively small investment in time and energy that brings people together and builds community. So if the time comes that the really big action is necessary, we're all on the same page. We're all together and we're all talking to each other. Ken in Montana, listening on KMPT. Hey, Ken, what's up? Ken?
Hello.
Hey, you're on the air.
Oh, hi, Tom. I enjoy your show.
Thank you.
First time listener. I've never heard your show before. We don't get it in the Spokane market in Washington. But I'm traveling across Montana and happened to pick you up on a Missoula station. Just wanted to let you know, for your listeners, a couple of books I recently read that you're probably familiar with, Free Lunch, How the Wealth of America has been Transferred from the Poor to the Rich over the Past 30 Years.
Yeah, that book's been out for several years.
Right, and then also Perfectly Legal,
mm-hmm.
another book by the same author, and I thought it was appropriate for your earlier conversation as we talk about the economic toilet that we're in the past 30 years.
Yeah. Yeah, excellent books. Ken, thanks a lot for the call and for listening. Tony in Beverly Hills, California, listening on K-Talk. Hey, Tony.
Yes, Mr. Hartman.
Yes, sir.
A few points. The photograph yesterday of Obama and his wife is pure Republican, typical right-wing trash.
You're talking about the cover of The New Yorker, the satire or whatever.
Don't call it satire. It's typical of what the Republicans have been doing. If I had a magazine and I could afford it, I would put an Oval Office picture with Hitler on the wall, and I'd have Cheney, Bush, and McCain there standing with wearing Nazi uniforms saying, Hi, Hitler.
That's what Keith has done over at What Now Tunes, and you can see it both at whatnowtunes.com and also at the tomhartman.com. We put his suggested illustration for the next issue of The New Yorker up, and it's actually John McCain wearing a Nazi outfit.
I know, it's terrible. I don't think it really should be done either side. It's terrible.
Yeah.
The other point was that I really hope, I pray we have a Democrat president. I mean, the last time in my opinion, I was 3 when FDR died, I'm 66. He did what had to be done domestically and in foreign policy. President Carter did what we had to do, have a national policy to get us free from Middle East oil. We need the right policies at home and abroad, and we can only get that with a Democrat president.
Yeah, you're absolutely right, Tony. Thank you very much for the call and excellent point. Ellen in Shelburne Falls, Massachusetts. Hey, Ellen.
Oh, yeah. Just that you mentioned a number of progressive organizations. What about Progressive Democrats of America?
Yes, absolutely. In fact, I think I'm on their advisory board, as I recall.
Okay.
PDA, absolutely.
And thank you very much.
You're welcome very much. Thank you, Ellen, for mentioning that. Joe in Portland. Hey, Joe.
Hi, Tom. Love your show. Just wanted to say about the New Yorker cover that the New Yorker is looked at by most people as a kind of an intellectual / elitist kind of news magazine that has very long journalist articles in it, mm-hmm. and of course Seymour Hersh is part of it. If you open the front cover of any magazine, of course, and you look down at the bottom of the table of contents, it'll show who the artist was of the illustration and what the title of it was. If you look under the table of contents there, it will say the name of the illustrator, and the title of it is The Politics of Fear.
Right. No, I know that.
I think that having said that, I think that people are kind of overreacting to this quite a bit. I believe that it was so tongue-in-cheek. It was so, not really that important and necessary to overreact. I think we're all kind of afraid how people who, you know, who are not as informed are going to take this.
Joe, I'm not kind of afraid of it. I'm looking at the polls. You've got 25% of Americans who think that Obama was raised in a Muslim madrasa.
I'm aware.
And they're
going to
walk by, and they're going to see that on the newsstands, and they're not going to get the joke.
Yeah, I suppose you have a very good point there, but I just wanted to say that I think it is really an elitist thing. It's the New Yorker really having no.
No, I understand. I understand. And the whole point of satire is to tell an unpleasant truth in a way that. That you know kind of punctures the victim of the truth, and for this to be a true, and thank you for the call, for this to be a true satire, because it's not a satire about Obama or his wife, it's a satire about the Limbaughs of the world and the rednecks of the world and the uninformed voters of the world who think that he is that caricature. So if you're going to satirize them, they have to be in the picture, and they're not.
Tom Hartman.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Ellen Ratner on the line with us with the Talk Radio News Service in Washington, D.C., our daily update of what's going on out there in the world, talkradionews.com. Hey, Ellen, welcome back to the United States of America.
Well, thank you so much. The president had a press conference today, and he talked about how Congress has failed to get 12 appropriations bills, none to him. He said that the banking system was sound. He starts talking about the psychology of oil prices. And that somehow if Anwar was to be involved in offshore drilling, then people would understand the psychology and that somehow they wouldn't be spooked by the oil prices.
Yeah, I actually have this clip. It's 14 seconds here. We can let our listeners hear this. This is Bush today.
They can pass energy legislation. Readily concede that, it's not going to produce a barrel of oil tomorrow, but it is going to change the psychology.
See, it's all about the psychology. We're just a nation of whiners. We need to be psychotherapized.
It is pretty amazing. I mean, I can't believe that I'm going to psychology. Nancy Pelosi just a few minutes ago also had a conference with several oil experts, and she wants him, the president, to at least release some of the strategic oil reserve. He said he was not going to do that. And then he talked a little bit about the economy. He was questioned twice, really, about the issue of privatization for Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. Went all around it, did not really answer that. And he said that it was not a bailout, that shareholders still own the company. Well, I don't understand, speaking of psychology, the psychology of that either.
Well, the shareholders do still own the company, but that doesn't mean that it's not a bailout. I mean,
exactly.
Yeah. I mean, Silverado, Neil Bush's SNL, the shareholders still owned it. The government just said, here's some extra money. United Airlines, after 9/11, they were in bankruptcy. The shareholders still owned it. The government just said, here's some money. I mean, not just United. I mean, I guess there were several airlines that got bailed out. A couple of different times over, since airline deregulation. It's
pretty amazing. I just also want to quickly go over some of the Bernanke stuff.
Ellen, you and I were in Sudan together on the Darfur border, and now Mr. Bashir, the president of Sudan, has been indicted you know, by the international.
He claims he's not going to take retribution, but the United Nations today said that they were actually going to start to pull some of the people out of there, except the most basic necessities, because they're very, very worried about him doing exactly the opposite of what he said he's going to do.
You're right. Yeah. So this is, man, any thoughts on what our listeners can do to help support the people in Darfur? I know Mia Farrow over at MiaFarrow.org has got a lot of great stuff on her website about this. I know there's some information at TalkRadioNews.com, CSI's work. Is the UN going to take this on? Do you know? I mean, what's beyond?
Well, you know, it's really hard. Yesterday, Secretary General. Ban Ki-moon had spoken actually to Bashir and said, you know, that he didn't have anything to do with the International Criminal Court, that that actually was a separate agency, and it was done quite independently because Bashir tried to put pressure on Ban Ki-moon to stop what was going on. Mm. And then, of course, there was this sort of rambling discussion or talk from the ambassador from the Sudan. But as you know, Sudan also, the vice president of Sudan is the man we met from southern Sudan.
Right, yeah, Salva Kiir. But and who seems to be a good guy. But he's down in the south. And I mean, that it's what we're seeing here, it seems to me, is the leading edge of a civil war on top of a disaster. And the Chinese are in there, you know, arming the North and buying the oil. And it's just making the whole situation worse. And then Bush says, oh, he's going to go to the opening session of the Olympics so that the Chinese don't lose face. And it's like, wait a minute, you know, they're not good players on the world stage at this moment, at least with regard to this.
Right. And the other thing that's going on, and I can't tell whether the Chinese are behind it or not, but I would imagine they are, is tomorrow morning, when the Dalai Lama is speaking in New York, somebody is organizing a bunch of monks to say that, you know, that the Dalai Lama is just making things worse.
Oh, yeah, he doesn't represent us. That's got to be, I mean, you know, China has trillions of dollars. They certainly can organize a demonstration.
Right, you can promise monks a whole lot of nice monasteries or whatever and get them on your side as well.
Yeah. Amazing. Okay, so what else is going on?
Well, the other thing, of course, is Bernanke's testimony before the Senate Banking Committee, and just saying, you know, of course, all the challenges. He said that the inflationary outlook is uncertain. He said that there are certainly revenue difficulties. He said that there is contraction, understatement of the universe, in housing activity. He said that he's not sure of the special liquidity programs and the effect that they have had. And he said, most importantly, there has been a decline in private payroll employment. Now, of course, you know, we look at employment statistic, unemployment statistic, but there's a lot of government employment in there.
Sure.
And he said that the sales of new homes, of homes that have just been built, have fallen. And that he is really concerned about real earnings being stagnant this year.
Yeah, these are all very, very bad economic indicators. Ellen, thanks a lot for dropping by.
Thank you.
Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. Coming up tomorrow, Terry Jeffrey, editor-in-chief of the conservative-leaning CNSNews.com, is going to drop by on the issues of the day. Plus, David Sirota, one of my favorite writers, his new book, The Uprising, an unauthorized tour of the populist revolt scaring Wall Street and Washington. We're going to talk about fair trade. And don't forget, my friends, activism begins with you. Democracy depends on you. Get out there, get active. Tag, you're it. We'll see you tomorrow.
You are listening to Tom Hartman.
For exclusive audio archives and more information, visit HartmanRadio.com.
This is the Tom Hartman Program. We'll be right back.